What do you mean, what makes it like, different?
What makes the difference to wash a dead body from a live body?
Well, it's not, it's no longer a joke.
What do you mean?
I mean, it's the end, it's curtains, it's over.
Yeah, but why is that, like, what actually feels different?
My name is Merle Parrish Gross. I am the grandmother of Rebecca on the paternal side.
Anything else?
I just turned 80, not just, a bit ago. I don't know, what is it that you want to know, Rebecca?
So right now I'm sitting in my room. I'm about to interview my grandmother, and there are just a lot of things I want to know about her. Despite us being very, very similar in many ways, she's the genetic source of my ADHD, despite hers being undiagnosed. We both cry at movies and plays, whether they're happy or sad. Our handwriting is almost illegible. It takes us until around 3 p.m. to put real pants on. We like to talk to and befriend strangers, and the list kind of just goes on. One thing I have yet to share with her is her fascination with and the sense of ease she has about death, both the death of others and her own death. And what I want to know from her at this moment is about her experiences with death, which requires some context. So she works at our synagogue and washes dead people, which my sisters and I have always made fun of her. She has a folder full of extensive detailed plans for what we should do when she dies, including meals to cook, things to say in her eulogy, just everything. So we always kind of make fun of her for spending so much of her life thinking about and being around death. So one day I received a call from my grandma, we call her Murmur, and she sounded quite frantic, and she was confused why she was getting a bunch of likes and comments on a private message that she thought she sent on Facebook. And little did she know, she had actually posted this message publicly 3 times for all 530 of her Facebook friends to see. So I'm gonna read a few excerpts from that post because I feel like the post is very revealing about her character and also gives a good introduction to some of her ideas about her own death. It's titled MKG Thoughts on 78 for a Death Overexpression Workshop. I'm 78. The time I have left is limited. I know I'm closer to the end. Yet I don't feel old or weak or sick or even vulnerable, but I'm hyper aware of how little time is left. I've wasted a lot of it, especially recently, and it makes me feel a little bad and sad that I don't keep my act together better. My step is sure, my voice is strong, and so is my appetite. Can you imagine? I don't care about my weight. It amuses me that the expiration date on my most recent Visa card is more optimistic than I am. I do not want more time than has been allotted to me. If it is written somewhere, then so be it. Though I hate surprises, let death take me by surprise. I want my grave marker to say, "She was fun while she lasted," and it should include my father's last name and my mother's too. Likely, I will never sort all the family pictures or read all the articles and books I've accumulated. I'd like to go out laughing or at least smiling and breathing on my own. I've been physically present with an unusual number of people at their time of death. Holding hands, crooning, talking, knowing the person is still living until their breath and heart stop. Those times were each a privilege of trust. I had an incredible 7 or so years as an interviewer of survivors of the Holocaust. I had lung cancer 11 years ago and a foot-long list of medical issues that I don't consider a threat. As an adolescent, I tried to kill myself, and the source of my unhappiness was never particularly clear, even less so today. I did not finish university, but I've managed to gather a lot of information. I'm not an expert at anything, but I've come to appreciate even that. Every day strikes me as extraordinary. I weep at even small displays of tenderness and affection. I experience every morning as a gift. I married my husband 56 years ago, and he still makes me laugh. Surely you understand my sense of profound gratitude for all that I have and have had. 2 incredible, easy, smart, funny, and happy sons, a daughter who is much more than an in-law, and 3 loving, respectful, funny, thoughtful, and smart, smart granddaughters.
Can you explain to me what Tahara is?
So Tahara is the name given to the ritual procedure that is used and has been used for probably thousands of years to prepare a Jewish body for burial. And it entails gentle washing and a symbolic ritual purification of the body. Everything is done very gently and lovingly and with great dignity and respect shown to the body. Women are the team, or we establish a team. The word itself, mm-hmm. I think Tahara means pure. Hevra Kadisha is the name of the group which performs the ritual. And the translation from Hebrew, burial society, but Hevra is the same stem as Haver, which means friend. Kadisha, which really has to do with Kiddush, or holiness. The first thing that happens when a Jewish community gets settled anywhere on the globe is they make certain that there's burial ground for members who die, because death is just inevitable. They consider that holy ground.
Well, do you believe that it's holy?
That any ground is holier than any other ground? No.
Or that doing Tahara is holy?
That has nothing to do with God. It has to do with respect for another individual. We wrote our own manual, the women did. We've added modern essays and poetry, snatches of poetry that are more suitable, we feel, to the community that we serve. As I say, often we know the person. What happens in a Tahara room is really we are the last to touch, to see, to feel, to speak with an individual. More often than not, at least one person, if not more, on the Tahara team has known the person. And so, in a sense, our mourning has begun. And we may share stories that we know of their lives. We actually speak to them as if they are still present and conscious, although we know dead is dead. They may not know me, but they will know my touch. The one element required of a person on a Tahara team who's serving on a Tahara team is something called kavana. Kavana, which is something that you're supposed to have kavana to pray, to really pray. And I don't really pray, but I do have a lot of kavana, meaning high intention of doing well, gently, lovingly, and properly with a dead person. And it's very interesting because throughout history, women have had permission to perform a tahara for males simply because in small villages, little towns in the shtetls, the men were off, I don't know, hunting, fishing, gathering, at war, maybe. And the women were left to do it. And because women don't have the issues of confused sexuality with men that men have with women, maybe because we've given birth.
Was there like a memorable one you've done?
In one case, it was for a little girl who was under 4 years old. Who had a brain tumor. A cousin of this little girl asked if we could, and I said, absolutely, we absolutely were available. I felt that this was not a time to use our manual, to use that we didn't have poetry that was right for this little girl. And so I asked the cousin if she would bring but maybe a storybook that had been a favorite of the child. And we know that the child was dead. But the cousin read like a good night story. And it was tremendously moving. And we made some decisions. We decided ordinarily where the body is dressed and also a kind of a bonnet is put on a person's head, and then the face is covered. We place clay shards on the eyes, the nose, the mouth. I kind of made the decision. I asked everyone how they felt about, like, I felt we should not cover her eyes. This was a little girl.
You normally cover people's eyes?
Yes, whose eyes were partly open in death. And she was probably one of those little children who sleep sometimes. Sometimes you used to sleep and your eyes would still be open and then they would be itchy the next day. And so we felt this was like a little girl who always needed to see, had to have her eyes available. I don't know what happens after death. I think nothing, but that's pretty hard to conceive. I was trying to think 4-year-old, and I just felt it would be wrong if we covered her eyes, and the entire team agreed. And so we placed the book in her very tiny casket, and she was dressed in a little tiny shroud. We dress the individual in shrouds called tachrichim. It was established many, many, many years ago, and everybody would be dressed the same because in death, we're all equal. And that was very moving. And another very, very moving one. Oh my God. A woman who spoke very little English died. We all recognized her, but didn't know her on a friendship basis. We had found some Hungarian music, which we played, thinking that would soothe. But Ava had come with a book of poetry also. And when the ritual was finished and we had closed the coffin, but Ava had something to read to her. And I don't understand a word of Hungarian. And she read a poem and we all wept. Because somehow through poetry, you get a sense of it. And we knew that she had apologized to her friend for wishing that to die already. Because we're never supposed to wish that. This poem was a poem of forgiveness for her friend, saying to her, you know, it's okay. Kind of like I said to you, we never feel that we're really absolving or cleaning anyone of sins, because I don't really believe anybody has sinned. What do you mean, what makes it different?
What makes the difference to wash a dead body from a live body?
Well, it's no longer a joke.
What do you mean?
I mean, it's the end. It's curtains. It's over.
Yeah, but why is that? Like, what actually feels different?
It's things that, because when we wash the body, we wash every part of it. So it's turned, and there are usually 3 people on one side of the table, 3 people on the other, and 1 person at the head to make certain the head doesn't go bobbling about. And for different people, some people become very, 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 very stiff, so stiff that it's almost impossible to put garments on them. And so, again, you know, you get creative and you say, it doesn't matter, we can rip this garment so that we shouldn't be disturbing the dead person, you know, trying to struggle them into it. And then, too, you can gently, gently, gently warm a person a little bit so that they're like, your elbow will bend. And you can get them into, no, they're not bending it themselves. But if you hold them, you can get it to bend because it's hard to dress a person. Yeah. And sometimes we laugh. We laugh, like once somebody pulled out a catheter and somebody leaned very close and anyway, they got sprayed with with urine. And you know, the first thing you do before you start a tahara, we apologize to the dead person for any indignity, for any discomfort we might cause. We wash our hands. We do dry our hands. We wash our hands not with a prayer. We simply say, bless these hands for the work they need to do. Before we start, we fill 3 buckets of water. From a woman, we remove nail polish. We clean under their fingernails and toenails. And so many women now have gel pedicures. You laugh. And I just said, we can't get in here with the acetone. Do you know? It's okay. She can go to God. God won't mind. I am sure God won't mind. It's not blaspheming. I'm not about blasphemy. If any stray hairs are fallen, actually, that's part of the tachrichim, is a little bag in which we place anything or any, like if there was a Band-Aid that then fell off and it had a little blood stain on it, we would put that in the bag. At the bottom of the casket, and the body is virtually always covered because we respect modesty. We uncover the parts of the body as we go, with the exception, the only time the body is fully uncovered is for the pouring the buckets, the 9 kavim. You pour in as close to a continuous motion. Mm-hmm. You start actually with the hair and then down the right side of the body. And then the next person goes as soon as that water is ending and we're saying, Tahora hi, Tahora hi, Tahora hi. You are pure, you are pure, you are pure. The second bucket of water is poured down the left side of the body. A third bucket of water is poured down the middle. The body is patted dry, and we try to do a really good job of drying because it's very hard to put on wet clothes, especially if the person can't be helpful. There is a belt called a gartel that is placed at the waist. And then, of course, we sprinkle Jerusalem soil at the bottom of the casket. And some of that is also sprinkled on women, on the heart, and on the reproductive organ area. And we're the last to see, to touch, because we don't have open caskets.
Have you ever felt like a sixth sense about someone who died, or like felt their, not their ghost, but like some part of them still there?
I knew my parents well enough, my friend Ronnie, who died when we were 45 years old. I sometimes still, because I knew her well enough, sometimes still think, oh, wait, is Ronnie here? Or my father or my mother? So it's like, I know that seems like a little bit woo-woo, but it's not, it doesn't trouble me.
Well, does that happen when you're doing Tahara?
No. It's because when I'm doing, I'm focused.
Sometimes you think it's a little funny that you spend so much of your life planning your death.
Well, it's not like that, because it really won't be up to me. Like, I have rewritten the 23rd Psalm. I have Shiva instructions. Save the lox, but throw out the sweets as they get crusty. And on the third night, you should order in Thai or Chinese. I don't know. You asked me something else. No, there's nothing creepy about it. It's a kind of a strange sisterhood.
Has it, doing it changed your ideas about death at all? Or like about your own death? Because I feel like I'm personally scared of dying, but whenever I talk to you about it, you...
No, I'm scared of dying too. But I'm not scared of death.
What's the difference?
But maybe I'm deluding myself. The dying part. It's the dying part. I mean, like, I'm old, but I'm not elderly. If I can't say genug, which means enough, I don't want treatment. The quality of my life is so much more important than the quantity of it. You know, maybe that's because I'm already 80, and because I had lung cancer 12 years ago. I'm thinking next year I should give my lung cancer a bar mitzvah for being gone, right? Yeah. And your mother the same. Your mother has been cancer-free now. Mm-hmm. Christmas will be December 7th, 12 years. Yeah. So, you know, we have a lot to be grateful for.
So why do you think people are scared of death then?
Because I think that they don't parse it, and they don't think about the dying part. And that they think that something happens that's so cataclysmic at the moment of death, maybe. And doctors deserve to be faulted for holding out the, well, there's maybe one chance in 10 million that we can give you another 6 weeks. I want somebody to say, hello, she wants to stay lucid. No more drugs. No more chemo. No. And I've been with people who are dying, and there seems to be something. I was in the room when Ava Schieber's husband died, and he suddenly sat up, as did Nahum. His eyes opened and he sat up as if they had seen something. I don't know what it is. Jesus supposedly came back, but then he didn't talk about it. So we have no idea. It could be the most wonderful thing, as Norman Lear says, could be the most wonderful thing that ever happened. But in the meantime, you are.
What?
The best thing that's ever happened. So I think the way the soul lives on is in the memory that resides in other people.